All right, thanks everyone. So I wanna start really fast by talking about some hardware trends that we're looking at Coho Data. So what this table is showing is one of the consequences of the increasing capacity of solid state drives. Within a couple of years, it's likely that we're gonna start to see drives on the market that have up to 128 terabytes of capacity in a single drive. And given the new smaller form factors for these devices, like M.2, it's imaginable that you might put up to 32 of these in a single 1U server. And when you do the math on that, that gives you about 4 petabytes of storage in a single server, which is a very remarkable number when you think about it. But as the table shows, the connectivity to these devices is not increasing at the same scale. In fact, it's more or less remaining constant. And the reason for this is because these devices are sitting on the PCIe lane, and each device is typically taking up 4 lanes. And the typical CPUs that we're using today, even modern, like enterprise-grade CPUs, are quite limited in the number of PCIe lanes they have. So like a Broadwell CPU would have on the order of 40, maybe 48 lanes. And if you're talking about presenting these devices over the network, you're going to dedicate at least half of those to your network interface. Right, so you're thinking like 200 gigabit lanes into the server. You're going to have about 20 PCIe lanes on the back end to connect to all your devices. So what that means is your back end PCIe bus is going to be quite oversubscribed and switched. So it's going to reduce the actual aperture to these devices. And we're seeing this as a problem today, even with modern devices. And it's not just related to individual hosts. So you see a similar connectivity issue when you expand out into the network. You might imagine a couple of these 2U servers or 1U servers, one in each rack in a data center, right? And they'll be connected by a Tor switch. And even in well-provisioned networks, these Tor switches, the cross-rack network connections are typically oversubscribed by a rate of 3 or 4 to 1. So consequently, for storage systems, the way that we place data in the distributed storage system and the way that we route connections to that data becomes very important. We have oversubscribed connections, and we have the ability for single kind of hotspot workloads to become severe bottlenecks in the system and degrade performance and scalability. So just to give you an idea of how different this is from the past decade or so of storage, this is a picture of a Google data center from around 2001. So this is about 2 years before they released their GFS Google File System paper, which is one of their early distributed storage papers. And that was a very nice paper. In that paper, they talk about scaling their system up. So their largest deployment at that time in 2003, they have 1,000 storage nodes serving hundreds of clients. And all of that was serving up about 300 terabytes of capacity, right? So we're talking about getting to the point where we could essentially provide that much capacity in about 3 SSDs in a couple of years. So we're looking at a very different scale of problem now than we have been in the past 5, 10 years. And Mirador is kind of our response to that problem. So Mirador is building on top of a larger system. It's a distributed storage system that we actually presented in a paper at FAST a few years ago called Strata. And this diagram is kind of showing you the block architecture of the storage system in general. So we have clients connecting via SDN-enabled switches to a mesh of storage nodes on the back end. And the storage nodes are all connected to each other, so they're all capable of serving requests from any client. And we leverage the SDN controller, software-defined networking controller, to allow us to direct clients to any given storage node on the back end. So within this system, Mirador is kind of the central control logic. And it's kind of akin to an SDN controller. In fact, it interfaces directly with the SDN controller to control placement of network connections. But as the diagram shows, it's also capable of interacting with the storage nodes themselves to initiate object copies to move data from one node to the other. And so the purpose of Mirador essentially is to constantly evaluate the configuration of the system, the placement of objects, data and network connections to improve performance, efficiency, and scale. And it does these kinds of reconfigurations basically on the scale of the order of minutes or hours. So we might reconfigure network connections very aggressively on the order of minutes and be moving objects around in the background on the order of hours. All right, so when we first built Strata, we were influenced by the SDN architecture. So I think there are a lot of nice properties of software-defined networking. In particular, separating the control plane from the data plane provides a nice way to offer programmatic control of the network. And making control decisions from a centralized location allows you to actually make better decisions with regard to resource allocation and whatnot. So we wanted to do the same thing in the storage domain, but we found that this is actually quite a bit more challenging, primarily because there are a lot more constraints we have to consider when we're placing data. We need to consider not only the network capacity, but also storage capacity, fault tolerance. There are a bunch of different dimensions that we need to optimize along. And additionally, when we want to reconfigure our storage system, if we were going to be moving objects around, that burns a bunch of resources, so it's not nearly as cheap as reconfiguring the network. So I just want to just go a little bit into more detail about what I'm talking about when I talk about placement in a storage system. So in a typical distributed storage system, your placement policy might want to consider things like replicating files across fault domains to ensure that you have adequate hardware tolerance, fault tolerance. But at the same time, you might want to be minimizing your cross-rack traffic. As I mentioned before, that's an oversubscribed link. So you can see immediately that these two goals can be conflicting, because to get hardware redundancy, you might want to replicate across racks, but at the same time, you want to avoid consuming that bandwidth. Your placement policy might also want to co-locate related files to take advantage of workload locality. But you might want to stripe files across devices so the performance of an individual file scales with all the devices. Obviously, when you're placing data, you need to make sure that the device has enough capacity to hold the objects you want to put on it and that it can provide adequate performance for the client workloads for those devices. What does that say? Right. And so when we're placing objects across the devices, we want to also make sure that we can rebuild the device if it fails. So we want to be able to copy data from multiple other devices when we rebuild the device in parallel. And we want to obviously balance load across all the nodes in the cluster as well. So there's a bunch of different constraints here that we need to take into consideration. And then you're going to run into a situation where all of these constraints get thrown out the window because some specific customer has their own requirements for their given workloads. Right. So this list is not necessarily exhaustive of all the considerations that we need to be aware of when we're placing data, but I think it kind of gives you ideas of the complexity of the system and the challenge that we're trying to solve here. So here is a diagram of the kind of three-stage pipeline that Mirador is implemented as. So as I said, it's a centralized controller. It's running all the time in the background as a service in our distributed storage system, and it basically works in three stages. So the first, we have a system monitor, which is constantly pulling the cluster and capturing resource utilization metrics. It also captures very detailed workload behavior profiles and uses this to construct the model of the file system, which it passes to the next stage in the pipeline, the planning engine or the optimizer. So this thing acts on the model provided by the monitor and a policy, which is a set of rules, which I'll talk more about in a second. And it searches for a new way to configure the system that improves the placement as defined by the policy. If it finds a new configuration, it constructs a migration plan, which describes how to achieve the new configuration and passes that to the scheduler. And this is the component in the system that is actually responsible for moving data and network connections across the cluster. And this scheduling problem itself is NP-hard. There's more details in the paper about how we approach it. But for the moment, I want to talk more about the planning engine, the policy optimizer itself. You can think of this essentially as the SDN controller for the storage network. Okay, so when I talk about policy, as I said, our policy is composed of multiple rules or objective functions, and the idea of each of these objective functions is they're a simple declaration of how a specific resource in the system should be utilized. So every objective function or rule has a cost assigned to it, and the costs essentially prioritize the harm of violating the individual rule. And then we apply like traditional artificial intelligence techniques, essentially to search for new configurations using these solvers to find improved layouts of data and network. So this is an example of an actual objective function that we use in production. As you can see, it's written in Python. All of this code is written in Python. And this particular rule is responsible for ensuring that load is balanced evenly across the cluster. So it accepts as input the file system model that I mentioned that is created by the system monitor and a specific device that it wants to consider. And what this rule does essentially is it looks at the load of the device under consideration, and it looks at the load of the least loaded device in the system. And if the relative difference between these two loads is beyond some threshold, then we declare that the system is imbalanced. Right. So one key takeaway from this rule definition is that it's showing you what is wrong with the system, and it's assigning a cost to that, but it's not making any suggestions about how to improve the state of the system. So the way that we actually make changes in the system is in the planning engine, in the pipeline. So the two main goals of the planning engine, again, are to minimize the aggregate cost of rule violations, but also a second and very important goal of this thing is to minimize the churn induced by the reconfiguration. So again, because when we're reconfiguring the system, we're moving objects that are potentially quite large, we want to minimize that work. So our framework provides a pluggable interface that allows us to use multiple different solvers, and we've experimented with a bunch. When we started, we initially built a branch and bound solver. We thought that was a very nice fit for this particular domain. And there's details in the paper about that, but it turns out it was quite problematic for us, especially because of the second requirement here, which is minimizing churn. Branch and bound solvers tend to induce a pretty high churn in the configuration space when it produces a new solution. So we went back to the drawing board again and implemented a second solver, which is a much simpler, greedy algorithm, but we found that in practice, it works quite well. And in fact, theoretically, it's shown to be a too optimal solution to the related makespan problem. So both in theory and practice, we found that it works very well for our use case. So the high idea from this slide is that these solvers are what are responsible for finding new configurations. We have policies that show us, or rules which show us what's wrong, and solvers which figure out how to fix things. Okay, so this is a picture of our production policy. It comprises 7 rules. They're all written in Python. You can see them. They're right there. And they govern things like load balancing, device and link utilization, tiering, replication, right? And this is the actual solver itself, right? So again, it's a greedy algorithm. We use a two-pass algorithm. And there's more details on the paper, but we've added a few augmentations to the algorithm, for example, to allow rules to provide hints to prune the search space, which we found dramatically reduces the runtime for this. But as you can see, this definition is very concise. So our entire policy, which we've developed over like a couple of years and added new rules as we've gone along, we express that in 220 lines of Python. And the solver itself, all the smarts of the system, is 128 lines of Python. And then there's a bunch of glue that makes it all work. But the fact that we're able to express this policy, and that a policy that gives us very good results in such a small amount of code, we found to be a very large advantage of the system. In fact, this is the second implementation of the system we built. And the previous solution, we used a more monolithic approach. We had a single policy engine that described both how to reconfigure the system and identify what's broken. And it turns out that implementation was a lot more complicated and a lot less fun to maintain or extend, right? So the previous implementation was 2,300 lines of Python compared to about 300 in the current implementation. So I think there's probably kind of a natural suspicion, especially among systems people, when they hear the word objective function or cost function, utility function. People are not convinced that this is going to solve all their problems, and in fact, it's not going to. I think I've already mentioned, right, we have multiple conflicting goals. That problem is kind of inherent in this configuration space. The fact that we can express those as independent goals and evaluate how they interact with each other makes our lives easier because it gives us knobs to adjust the overall behavior of the system, but it does not eliminate this tension, right? So the way that we handle this problem in practice is with very extensive testing. So this is an example of a test case that we use in production. It's not super important that you understand what's going on here besides the fact that it's a declarative specification of an initial cluster configuration and sort of the expected output of applying a policy to this thing. And one thing I guess I would note from this test case is it shows that we have preconditions and postconditions which list rules that might be violated for a configuration, and this test shows that the postcondition does have an expected violation. And what that's implying is that there are cases where you expect the solver to choose to violate one rule so that you can resolve the violation of another rule, right? So that's where assigning cost comes in. It's exactly by assigning the right cost to these rules that you make them behave the way that you want to when they're combined. So this testing is actually where we spend a lot of our time. In terms of lines of code, it by far dwarfs the implementation. We have like 12,000 lines of code. But again, I would say that the need to test these policies is not unique to this specific implementation. It's unique to the high dimensionality of this problem. And you need this kind of thorough testing no matter how you want to express your policy. Okay, so quickly I want to talk about evaluation of the policy engine that we're using. So this is evaluating the greedy solver. This is in a simulated cluster where we can easily scale up the number of objects and devices in the system. And the test harness essentially randomly populates the cluster with the number of objects specified. And we use a simple load balancing policy to try to search for a zero cost solution that balances load while maintaining our hardware redundancy requirements for these specific configurations. And I would note here that the object count, these objects are actually quite large. They're on the order of like 20 gigs. They're actually slices of VM disks. They're not traditional small objects. But the takeaway here, the greedy algorithm is scaling like linearly times the log of the number of objects being reconfigured, and it's also proportional to the log of the devices. So we can see as we get up into the hundreds of thousands of objects, we're looking at roughly a minute necessary to reconfigure like 600 objects. In practice, this has been a reasonable overhead for us because when you consider the fact that we're actually going to be moving now 520 gig objects around, that time obviously is going to dwarf the planning time here. So we found that this works reasonably well in practice. Now, there are a bunch of examples in the paper of kind of cool things that we can do with policy placement because we have this nice expressive framework. So in the paper, we actually take advantage of very detailed workload profiles. So we dynamically capture working set sizes and see how they change over time. And we can incorporate these into our placement policies. So this allows us to do kind of interesting things like bin packing workloads according to their working set size rather than according to the absolute size of the objects that we're looking at. And it lets us do things like isolate noisy neighbors, so individual workloads that might burn your cache and have very poor locality, we can isolate those to single devices and minimize their effect on other objects in the cluster. And finally, we look at some techniques for workload co-scheduling. So if you have bursty or periodic workloads, we can do some analysis and install rules in the placement policy that actively migrate workloads so that workloads that have these sort of phase behavior are not interfering with each other. They're isolated on separate devices. So I will refer you to the paper. I don't have a lot of time to go into the details, but you'll see some of the sort of performance improvements that we get with these techniques in the paper. Okay, so in conclusion, Mirador is our sort of central storage controller, and it actively migrates data and network flows within the cluster to optimize for performance, scale, and efficiency. And one of the main challenges faced by this system is the high dimensionality of the configuration space. And we found that an effective technique for approaching this problem is to treat configuration as a search problem, to leverage established artificial intelligence techniques to optimize that search. And yeah, that's all I have. Thank you.
Any questions?
So that's good. I like the clean, nice approach. I'm a little worried about the greedy solver scalability. So when you have 100,000, 20 gig objects, which is 200 terabytes of data. So how big do your systems plan to get?
Yeah, they'll definitely get bigger than that. So the scalability issue, this is really just stressing like a micro benchmark for the solver. In practice, you're often going to take a more statistical approach where you're going to sample objects and move things around. In fact, we talk about in the paper how you can prioritize that sampling, right? So you can pick objects along a specific dimension that are in most violation of a given rule. Prioritize just looking at those guys, right? So in practice, you're not going to churn through a billion objects and try to reconfigure them all at the same time. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So I have a question. How much of the new functions that you mentioned in the last slide are actually being used out there, or you have customers? How much of this is deployed in general?
So the production policy that we use is much more conservative. It's more concerned about maintaining hardware redundancy and load balancing. The kind of like workload analysis policy stuff, that's more valuation for the paper, so we're not using that in production just yet. Yeah.
Do you have any mechanisms to avoid thrashing the system by over-moving stuff?
Yeah, so the rules that you define, you want to kind of define them in a way that will avoid this thrashing. We haven't actually found that to be a big problem right now. You also need to kind of regulate how aggressively you're moving things around. That's another thing that requires a bit of tuning in the system, but yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.